I thought in these two studies we'd look at the man John Mark. Now, if you can find your way to Acts chapter 1, we'll take a reading there. This man, John Mark, is the man who wrote Mark's Gospel. And as you're probably aware, people in New Testament times quite often had two names. Simon Peter, for example. John Mark. John, the Hebrew name. Mark, the Roman name. Now, we're going to read a number of sections here in the book of Acts. This first one doesn't actually mention Mark, but you'll see why I've read it in a few moments. It's in chapter 1, and it concerns the ascension of Jesus Christ after he returned to his Father from the Mount of Olives. In verse 20, Jesus had returned to heaven, and then the apostles returned to Jerusalem. They returned to Jerusalem in verse 12, and in verse 13, when they had entered Jerusalem, they went to the upper room, which means the upper room where the Last Supper was held the night before Jesus died. The people are mentioned: Peter and John, James and Andrew, Philip and Thomas, Bartholomew and Matthew, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon the Zealot, and Judas the son of James. All these, with one accord, devoted themselves to prayer, together with the women and Mary the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. Now across to chapter 4, verse 36. Here we are introduced to a man called Joseph, but he was surnamed by the apostles Barnabas. So there again you have the two names. Barnabas means son of encouragement. He was a Levite and a native of Cyprus. He sold a field which belonged to him, and he brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. This was part of the early church's plan to pool their resources so that they could help the poor among them. Barnabas, we are told later on in Paul's letter to the Colossians, was a cousin of Mark. Over to chapter 12. This is the story of Herod's attempt to execute Peter. He had just executed James, the brother of John, and when he saw how popular this was among the Jews, he decided to execute Peter. And then we have this remarkable story of how Peter escaped the angel opening the door and so forth. Well, when he realized that he was actually free in verse 12 of chapter 12, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark. Peter goes to the house of John Mark, owned by Mary, the mother of John Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gateway, a maid named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy she did not open the gate, but ran in and told that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You're mad." But she insisted that it was so. They said, "Well, it must be his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. Later on in the chapter, the final verse actually, verse 25, Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem, and they took with them John, whose other name was Mark. That is, they went from Jerusalem, where Mark lived, back to Antioch. And then we find in chapter 13 that they set off on what has become known as Paul's first missionary journey, Paul and Barnabas together. And in verse 5, at the end of the verse, they had John Mark to assist them. So they went through the island of Cyprus and then sailed across onto the mainland of Asia Minor. But in verse 13, when they had got to Perga, we find in the second half of the verse that John left them and went back to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, Paul and Barnabas went on their journey throughout Asia Minor, and when they had evangelized much of the southern part of the province of Galatia, which was one of the main provinces of Asia Minor, they returned to their home base in Antioch in Syria. Now just leave it there for the time being. Well, what do we know about Mark? Well, firstly, we know that he comes from a family which is fairly well-to-do. His mother owns a large house. It's large enough to accommodate lots of people. as we see in the story in chapter 12, when Peter came out of jail, he found that there were many people gathered in the house of John Mark. So it was a large house, which means that the family of John Mark was fairly well-to-do. They could afford a servant, at least one servant, and many of the early Christians were drawn from the ranks of the lower classes, the poorer people, slaves and others. Here was a family which had a large house and which was wealthy enough to afford at least one servant. A further picture is that Barnabas, a relative, was a wealthy landowner. Not many people owned their own land. It was only the wealthy who could afford that luxury. So we get the impression that Mark comes from a fairly well-to-do background. His home is in Jerusalem. He lives in a fairly large house in Jerusalem. That house was the house where Peter knew he would find the apostles meeting. When he got out of jail, he knew that if he wanted to find them anywhere, he would find them in the house of John Mark, which indicates that the house of John Mark had become the regular meeting place for the apostles and other leading Christians in Jerusalem. That's why it is that it is usually assumed that the house we read of in chapter 1 was again John Mark's house, the house of the upper room. Certainly the house we read about in chapter 1 of Acts is the same house where the Last Supper was held. It was a large upper room furnished where the Last Supper was held. I'm suggesting that that house belonged to John Mark. Now, we're not told clearly that the house of the upper room in chapter 1 is the same house as that of chapter 12. We do know that the house in chapter 12 is Mark's house. The house in chapter 1 probably is the same house. It's natural that that's where they had become accustomed to meeting. They had met there for the Last Supper. They automatically came back there after the resurrection 6 weeks later. And now, only a few weeks later again, we find them in John Mark's house, probably the same place. There's another point which indicates that it was the same house, and that's the story in Mark chapter 14 of the young man who went off naked into the night. Do you remember how the Roman soldiers tried to grab him and they managed to get hold of his cloak, but he escaped? The reconstruction is something like this. If that house, the house of the upper room, was John Mark's house, Jesus met there with his disciples for the Last Supper. After this, they went off to the Garden of Gethsemane. It was dark, well on into the night. Mark, the teenage boy, the young man of the house, had probably been aware of things that were happening, that there was a lot afoot that night. He may have been asleep, he may have just followed them off into the dark. But let us suppose that what had happened was that he had got ready for bed, and in those days they just wore a loincloth, which is still fairly common pajama wear for people in the East. Just a loincloth and you lie down and that's bed. Jesus and his disciples had gone up to the Garden of Gethsemane, and there Judas had come with his motley crew of Roman soldiers and Jewish officials to arrest Jesus. Now, we know there'd been a bit of a scuffle there, with Peter trying to lop somebody's head off and getting only his ear instead, and various other things happening. News of what was afoot must have got back to John Mark's house. And immediately, when this rather impetuous young man heard what was afoot, he grabbed the nearest cloak he could find, just threw it around him, and raced off into the night to see what was happening. He got caught in the scuffle. The soldiers grabbed him. He managed to wriggle free. They were left carrying the cloak, and he, of course, got off into the night. It says naked, although I think we have to understand that the word naked in these contexts doesn't mean stark staring naked as we might think. I've found in the East that quite often people use this expression to mean clad only in your loincloth. That's virtually used as the same expression, and most likely that's what happened with our friend Mark. We're not told in the story in Mark that that was Mark, but it's been believed universally since the earliest of times that indeed that was the young man who wrote the gospel. And quite often you find that people included stories of themselves. They didn't use their own name, but they included stories of themselves as a sort of short autograph that was inserted into the story. Now, that's the general reconstruction that I suggest to you. Now, it's not watertight, I'm well aware of that, but you see the picture that we're building up. At least there are some things we are certain of, and I think we can learn some lessons from these. Firstly, we are certain that the parents of John Mark used their house for God. The Christians came regularly. Peter knew that that was where he was going to find the other Christians. And that's the sort of houses I believe we should be working towards. Using our houses for God, not just in the sense of having meetings there, but being a lot more open with each other. And instead of this habit which has developed of meeting each other in the gospel hall and not seeing each other in our homes, we have to get away from that. And I'm sure that a lot more can be accomplished as we are more hospitable, we are more relaxed, we are more free and easy with our access into each other's homes, and less dependent upon the church building as the place where we meet and have fellowship. Hospitality is a dying grace among Christians. We have become so self-sufficient with the type of lifestyle that has developed. We are economically more self-sufficient than we ever were. Our homes provide us with most things. And the general tendency is towards isolating ourselves from other people because we are completely self-contained units. And we are the losers as we diminish this social intercourse with other people. We simply should be getting to know each other a lot more and getting to know our neighbours and our non-Christian friends in the context of informality, not constructing a meeting in the home, but using our homes to break down the barriers and to get to know each other and to get to know our non-Christian neighbours better. And there's no doubt that it has a tremendous rub-off on the family. I know from our experience in Thailand, where we had all sorts of people through our house always, and similarly, since we've been home, we have all sorts of people coming through our house. Not only Christians, but non-Christians, neighbours, people from school and from work. We've had quite a few Christian workers of different shapes and colours through the place. And I can see the beneficial effect that this has had on our own children, that they haven't grown up in a narrow little world where the only people they've known are those of their own set. But there's great exposure to all sorts of people, and particularly to some of the well-known Christian workers that we've had through. And we can see what a good effect this has on the development of children. That's the sort of atmosphere that John Mark benefited from. Peter, John, Andrew, Bartholomew, Matthew, these were the people that were coming to his house all the time. And Mark, the young man of the house, even though he may not have been in on their discussions all the time, he was meeting these chaps. He was having cups of tea with them, and he was talking with them, and he was listening to them as they talked with others. And as youths, young people, listen and observe their parents and their friends talking, they are going to be affected, for better or for worse. And in many cases, I'm afraid it is for the worse when they see some of the gossip and some of the politicking and the nastiness that goes on, and they get cheesed off, they get browned off. They get jaded and cynical. If, on the other hand, they're seeing this other side of Christianity, what a benefit it can be to them. I suspect that Mark was rather attracted to Peter, that Peter was perhaps the one that Mark felt most affinity with. Mark strikes me as being a fairly impetuous sort of person, much the same as Peter was, and it's natural that he would find a hero in a person of Peter's ilk. Now you find the impetuosity of Mark illustrated, for example, in that story of how he goes tearing off into the night as soon as he hears there's a kerfuffle on up there in the garden. Off he goes, out for the adventure. You see it again here in Acts chapter 13. Off he goes as the zealous young man with Paul and Barnabas. And for some reason, he just leaves them. And Paul, we read later on, considered that to be irresponsibility. It was something he shouldn't have done. But it's something that we can understand. Two of Mark's closest friends among his seniors were Barnabas and Peter. Now, there's an interesting story here. If we go back to Acts, where we left off, at the end of the missionary journey that Paul and Barnabas went on, we find when they got back at the end of chapter 14, beginning of chapter 15 of Acts, that they found, while they were staying there in Antioch, that certain Jewish Christians from Jerusalem came to Antioch. And it says in verse 1, they were teaching the brethren that unless you are circumcised according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. And in verse 5, they said, it's necessary to circumcise them and charge these Gentile converts to keep the law of Moses. It created quite a stir in Antioch. And these Jewish teachers were so persuasive that even Barnabas and Peter got carried away with their arguments. And we find that Barnabas and Peter, who previously had been mixing freely with the Gentiles, were persuaded by the strong arguments of these Jewish chaps from Jerusalem that they should withdraw from the Gentile converts and not be so free in eating with them. Because the Gentiles, as you know, didn't really care what they ate, whereas the Jews had very strict religious food laws. These had been done away with as far as the Christian was concerned, but the arguments of these legalists were so convincing that Barnabas and Peter were carried away. Paul was there at this time, and not only were things happening in Antioch, but these teachers from Jerusalem had gone to the recently planted churches in Asia Minor, the churches that Paul and Barnabas had planted, and they had been telling the Christians there that they had to submit to the Jewish law. And Paul was so angry about this that he sent off the letter to the Galatians. Galatia, of course, was one of the provinces of Asia Minor. And he sent off this letter to the Galatians to correct the error that had appeared. In that letter to the Galatians, he refers to what I just mentioned. He refers to how Barnabas and Peter got carried away. This is what he says. When Peter came to Antioch, I opposed him to his face because he stood condemned. Before that, before these men came from Jerusalem, Peter used to eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew, and he separated himself, fearing the circumcision party. And with him the rest of the Jews acted insincerely, so that even Barnabas was carried away. Even Barnabas, that had gone with me on my missionary trip and preached to the Gentiles and seen many of them converted, even Barnabas, he says, got carried away. He then goes on to say that I withstood him to his face. And the upshot of it all was that Peter and Barnabas saw the error of their ways and admitted that Paul was right, and so they joined with the Gentiles again. Now, this problem was very widespread, and as a result, we find that the people from Antioch thought, look, let's go to Jerusalem. That's where this problem has arisen. Let's go to Jerusalem and deal with this matter, because we are not going to allow the gospel to be distorted by Jewish legalists. So they went to Jerusalem and had a big meeting with the leaders of the church there. And we find as we go there that Barnabas supports Paul. You see that in chapter 15, verse 12. Barnabas and Paul related what signs and wonders God had done through them among the Gentiles. And we find in verse 7 that Peter also supported Paul. The outcome of that meeting was that the leaders of the churches of Antioch and Jerusalem were united that no religious barriers were to be erected, no Jewish laws were to be imposed upon these Gentile Christians. And now Barnabas and Peter, who previously had tended to drift off because of the persuasive arguments of the legalists, they come back now and they are totally supportive of Paul as they had been previously. Well, at the end of that meeting, Paul said to Barnabas, look, let's go and visit these places back in Galatia and encourage them, because they've been troubled by this legalistic teaching. And Barnabas said, yes, I think it's a good idea. Let's take Mark with us. So if you come to chapter 15, verse 36, you find that Paul says to Barnabas, let us return and visit the brethren in every city where he has proclaimed the word of the Lord. Verse 37, Barnabas wanted to take John Mark. Verse 38, Paul thought it best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone on with the work. And so, verse 39, there arose a sharp contention. They separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. Paul chose Silas and went back to Asia Minor. Now, how does this affect John Mark? Well, you see it coming in there at the end of the story. Now, this again is pure conjecture on my part. I wonder whether the reason that John Mark left Paul and Barnabas so suddenly and went back to Jerusalem was that he was not happy with this open fraternization that Paul and Barnabas were practicing among the Gentiles. Remember that Mark was from Jerusalem, and Jerusalem was where these legalists had their base. And Jerusalem was always a problem in the life of the early church because of this legalism that was there among the Jewish Christians. Barnabas was not from Jerusalem, he was from Cyprus. Paul was not from Jerusalem, and they had a more broad-minded attitude. But maybe that experience in Antioch and a subsequent meeting in Jerusalem changed not only Peter and Barnabas, but changed Mark also. Perhaps now Mark has seen the error of his ways and he wants to have a second chance. He agrees now that Peter and Barnabas and Paul have got the situation correct. They are clear now that the gospel goes to the Gentiles without any Jewish restrictions imposed upon them. Mark is now convinced and he wants to go with them. But Paul says no. He considered that Mark needed a few more years of maturity. He felt that he had shown a lack of responsibility. Barnabas doesn't agree, and so we find that Paul and Barnabas have an argument and they part company. Lots of things have been said about this difference between Paul and Barnabas. Look, let's face it. We do have arguments, and we can't expect that always we're going to agree about everything. We're not to be idealistic and think that nothing's ever going to go wrong. But as I look at this story, I see it as a very down-to-earth presentation of some of the realities of the Christian life. And out of it all, good came. Concerning Mark, although Paul refused to take him with him on this trip, Paul did not write him off completely. Later on, we're going to see, if I remember when I get to that point, that Paul recommended Mark to the church in Colossae. He says, in fact, if he comes to you, he can be a help to you, and I recommend him to you. Now, that was many years later, admittedly. But you see, Paul knew that one failure was not the end. He considered the failure was sufficient reason for him to refuse taking Mark with him this time. But it wasn't the end. He didn't write him off. He wasn't one of these chaps that you meet from time to time who says, I remember 15 years ago he did this and this and this, and they never forgive and they never forget. Paul was not like that. And although Mark failed this time and Paul refused him, he did not write him off completely. And at the very end of Paul's life, the two people that he most wanted to come and visit him were the two who, as young men, had set off with him on his missionary journeys, Mark and Timothy. That was when Paul was on his last legs, when he was about to face the executioner in Rome. So one failure is not the end. There's another lesson comes out of this, and that is that Mark did not get sullen. He didn't pack up his goods and say, okay, if that's the way you like it, I'm taking my cricket bat home. He wasn't like that. Some people are very touchy. They get refused something, or they find they don't get their way, the way they wanted it, and so they say, well, if that's the way they want it, they can have it, and I'm not having anything more to do with it, and they get very indignant, and away they go, and they sit in the corner and sulk. Mark didn't do that. He was still keen to serve. Now, there are lessons in it for all of us, I believe. If we're the type that is likely never to forget and write a person off completely because of one blunder, well, then let us learn from this lesson. If we're the other type who take offence easily, who get in a huff and say, because I wasn't invited or because somebody didn't do this or didn't do that, well, I'm not going to have anything more to do with them, and they can muddle along as best they like without me, and they can all stew in their own juice and it serves them right, because if I was there, I could have fixed it for them. If we're going to be like that, let us learn from Mark. Mark was not like that. He was still keen to serve, and off he went with Barnabas. The story's not quite finished. We're nearly through for now. We find in chapter 16, verse 6, they went through the regions, that's Paul and Silas, they went through the regions where they had planted their churches previously and where the letter to the Galatians had been sent, southern part of Asia Minor. When they wanted to come into Mysia in verse 7 and Bithynia, that is the northern parts of Asia Minor, the Holy Spirit would not allow them. And in the end, they went across into Greece. The reason that they did not go there, or one of the reasons, I believe, was that that part, northern Asia Minor, was being reserved for Peter to evangelize. We're not told this in the Bible, but there is ample evidence in early records that the northern parts of Asia Minor, that is those provinces bordering the Black Sea, were evangelized by Peter, and he had Mark as his helper. And the story goes that after Mark accompanied Barnabas to the island of Cyprus, Mark then attached himself to Peter, and they embarked upon this extensive evangelistic work in the northern provinces of Asia Minor. Later on, Peter, when he was towards the end of his life, wrote a letter to those churches, 1 Peter. And at the very beginning of that letter, he introduces himself and he says to the Christians in Pontus, Galatia, that's northern part of Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. All of those areas are the northern parts of Asia Minor that Paul had been refused entrance to because God had those set aside, you might say, for Peter. And it was Peter with Mark who evangelized those, just as Paul with others had evangelized other parts. And just as Paul wrote letters to the churches he founded, so Peter wrote this letter to the churches that he had founded. And at the end of that 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 14, as he sends greetings to those people, he says, I send greetings, and so does my son, Mark. It was the custom for the leader to refer to his offsider as his son. And just as Paul referred to Timothy as his son, so Peter refers to Mark as his son. And so Mark finally becomes Peter's offsider. Similar in character, these two chaps. Perhaps a little impulsive and impetuous at times. But the point comes through again that we all have something to contribute. We are all different personalities, all different temperaments. And although we may not rub along so well with one person, surely there's someone somewhere that we can rub along with. And here in the story of Mark's adventures, we see again how this man found that there was somebody he could work with, and he made a great contribution to the growth of the early church.